Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, mind control. Is it real? We speak to Neil Sanders about MKUltra and LSD. Anissa Mirra also talks about it in Bristol. And Eco-Villages, a great UK eco-village project for 1,000 people, which was killed off by the government. Plus our weekly news update with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. And also, Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753, and I'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So we start with Anissa Mirra. Hi, Anissa, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi.
Now, first of all, mind control in Bristol, that's not possible, surely?
Well, it's not, but I guess things can be possible.
Now, brainwashing. I mean, this is something that you wanted to talk about. Why? What did you made you want to bring this up this week?
This is a really weird story, but I was at the doctor's recently, and I was in the third row in the waiting room, and the two first rows were all fixated on this cartoon character on the TV screen. And like it was on the TV screen was quite high up and it was on the right hand side, and they all just had their head turned and literally not one of them moved away for about 3 minutes. And I was like, imagine if this was on a huger scale.
Well, it is, isn't it? In a way, millions of people are watching television. There's one thing particularly about screens, whether that's computer screen or a television screen, is they flicker, don't they, at a certain rate.
Yeah.
Now, apparently, I mean, I don't know whether this is true or not, but you know, you can look this up. But apparently, that particular rate is designed to be just about perceivable. Almost the flashing of it is just about beyond your ability to perceive it, and so it really does kind of grab the attention of your brain, because your brain doesn't know, is that flickering or is it just a steady picture? And almost, you know, it's like almost like people, or if you watch, go past a TV shop or a department store with televisions in the window, people almost always look, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It's really weird. And it's just like, if I don't know, like every single person has like stops and looks, like I wonder what's going through their minds, or do they think it's just a normal thing to sort of just catch it and then look away?
Well, people think a lot of this is crazy stuff, but actually it's been proven recently in the United States that for literally decades, adverts that were put on at the end of film showings, you know, in the movie studios,
yeah,
in the cinemas, actually had subliminal messages in there saying, like single frames saying obey the government. And what they've done is they've slowed these things down now. It's pretty frightening to watch. You can have a look at it online.
Oh, wow.
Where for decades Americans, as far as I know, it wasn't happening over here, I don't know for sure, but certainly it's been proven in the United States that there were subliminal messages being put through to members of the public in American cinemas right across the country. So anyway, back to the doctors, just describe that scene and what was going through your mind. You were, I hope, weren't necessarily watching the TV like everyone else.
No, I wasn't. Well, like, I've obviously, once you sit down, you sort of just gaze around the room, which I guess everyone else does. But then I sort of just noticed everyone's head sort of slowly turning at a time. And I was, there was this young kid that was just so fixated on it. And his mum was either just reading the magazine, but then she'd suddenly just turn and just look at it like he was. And I don't think everyone realised that they were all actually looking at it at the same time.
Like, so what was on the screen?
It was literally just a cartoon character running around trying to hit another cartoon character. But like, it's such a simple advertisement. Obviously, I don't know.
What, so was it an advert? Was it actually an advert? Or was it something to do with the doctor's surgery? Was it targeted at people who were there? Or was it there to just sort of distract people? Because sometimes being in a doctor's surgery can be a bit of an uncomfortable, I mean, especially if you've got something wrong with you, you're getting a bit worried about seeing your doctor. You know, was it the idea to distract people, or was it an actual advert, a subtle advert?
It could. Well, I don't think it was very subtle. I think it was there to obviously distract people, to obviously take their minds away of the people worrying. But I think it's just kind of what was worrying in itself, to know that so many people were just so hooked on it, and it was like they probably wouldn't notice it if they'd like seen it on TV, like if their son was watching it, like they probably wouldn't have noticed it. But the fact that they were all just so like that they was just like involved in it, I don't know, it probably did have certain meanings. I mean, imagine if they had signs flashing and no one really took notice of it. I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I think it would be like, especially with the characters, they're knocking each other's heads and stuff, violence. But then that's very harsh. That's probably going too extreme into the meanings and stuff, but it could be possible.
Well, a capitalist society, someone's maybe come along and said, well, this is good for your surgery. It's going to distract people so they don't have to think about their illness and possibly sell something at the same time. I mean, that's how these things happen. That's probably how it's come into the surgery. Is that right?
Probably. I mean, before, I remember years ago, they didn't even have a TV there, and now they do, and now they have advertisement, and now people just seem to be so... Before, there were signs saying there was no... You weren't allowed to have mobile phones, because it would distract the currency and stuff, but now everyone's happy to use it.
Well, it's not just in doctor's surgery, it's also in city centres, isn't it? I've noticed, I mean, I was in Birmingham recently, a great big TV screen showing the tennis. About three people were watching it. Most of the rest of the public had other things, better things to do. They have one in just outside the galleries in the city centre for a while, yeah, which didn't seem to be all that popular. If they were going to show something like that, I mean, I'd quite like to see some kind of, in the evening, maybe an old-fashioned 1940s film, a black-and-white film, something that was actually worth watching. And maybe people will watch a bit of it. But the trouble is, of course, people aren't going to be there for a great deal of time. Anyway, what do you think about how many people believe what we read and see?
I think it's kind of worrying. A lot of the media these days, it's just obviously full of very escapism news and stuff. But the fact that people get so fixated on it, like on my Facebook page, there's so many people talking about stories of celebrities or getting their nails done and then... like the best nails in town or something, but then so stuff don't actually really matter.
But I mean, surely, you know, girls have always been interested in fashion and, you know, looking good.
True, but then I've always been a tomboy, so I can't really judge on that factor, unfortunately.
So how do we decide whether to believe or whether not to believe what we're reading and what we're seeing on TV, listening, hearing on the radio?
I think it's up to us. I mean, it's a bit... Obviously, I think if there's one person in the corner shouting down your ear, don't believe it, don't believe it, and everyone else has stood there, they'll obviously think, well, that person's kind of insane, don't listen, talk to that person. I think as humans, we're very, very judgmental, and I think that's what holds us back from obviously seeing the truth, or we're fearful of the truth.
Well, we certainly can't trust, I think, many of our big media organisations, that includes Sky, ITN, the BBC, to tell us the truth, because they're likely to give just a small part of it. I mean, there are big, big things at stake in things, wars, for example, in the Middle East, over Libya, Iraq, this kind of thing. How can we find sources, Anissa, where we can actually start to trust again?
To be honest, it depends on the individual where they look. I mean... We're in Britain, so it's going to be very Britain-sided. It's all basically what they see, so they're going to tell us what they see. But within the war, like the past wars, like World War One, World War Two, they used to be like, oh, their soldiers are having such a great time, and they used to like send out like all the propaganda and stuff. But obviously, that wasn't happening, and behind closed doors, no one really knows.
Well, one of the interesting things is if you go back to the Second World War. The British had a policy of allowing the German broadcast to be picked up around Britain. I mean, they could have tried to jam them. There was a guy called Lord Haw-Haw. He was a British lord who was over there broadcasting. King Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson, even very few people realise this, actually tried to get into Nazi Germany. That was the former king who'd abdicated, who was having a relationship with a Nazi spy. Mrs. Simpson, they actually tried to get across into Nazi Germany. Imagine that, if they'd had the former king on the radio telling all the British people, oh, Hitler's a wonderful chap. But we didn't, this is the point I'm trying to make, we didn't actually try and jam those signals during World War II. We allowed everyone to listen to him. The situation now, of course, is very different. The Syrian news in English and the Iranian news channels in English have all been blocked and jammed from coming across in Britain now. The satellites have been closed down, or the satellites haven't, they've just blocked those channels. Also, even the YouTube channel of Press TV, the Iranian channel, their account has been closed by Google. So it's a very different situation now to World War II. I'm going to ask you again, how do we find information we can trust now?
I honestly don't know. I think this world is completely falling apart. They're either saying that they don't want to cause a moral panic, so they're helping us, or but really they're just helping themselves. I don't know, it's insane. I don't think I can answer that one.
And we're in a funny situation where whole swathes of population in different parts of the world believe different things because they're only watching certain channels.
That's
it's very
true,
strange.
Yeah.
Anyway, Anissa, thanks for bringing it up. And
thank
right from the doctor's
much.
Surgery to international satellite channels, a very interesting conversation. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
I'm joined now by Neil Sanders on the line. Hi, Neil, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, you have written a book called Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, and it's
yes.
about mind control. Now, your studying in the past has been psychology, media production and film studies. What on earth made you decide to go and have a look at mind control?
Well, to be quite honest, when you sort of do study media and psychology, you tend to find an overlap between the sort of disciplines, and then you start to notice that there's a lot of overt controls in advertising, and there's a lot of overt controls in film production and entertainment and stuff. And you know,
when you say overt control, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean just the construction of an image or the construction of an icon in a character. I mean, these will draw back on sort of Jungian archetypes of heroes, heroines and stuff like that. I mean, a very, very simple one is just basically if you've got a camera looking up at somebody, they look very authoritarian. If you've got a camera looking down on somebody, they look diminished or weak. And so these are all based on instinctual drives and such like that, and often they're used in advertising and film in a manner that is not immediately apparent to the viewer, and often that is the point for it not to be immediately apparent to the viewer, because when it does become apparent, it loses its effectiveness. And in the advertising, for example, it would be placing a product next to a beautiful woman, or aligning a product with a celebrity who is considered to be sort of an alpha member of the tribe, so to speak.
Now, Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own is a pretty, I suppose, big claim to make. And many people would say mind control, well, that's just poppycock. Now, what about origins of this? I mean, I know certainly in terms of espionage and spy agencies, they certainly would be looking at whether they can control minds. But is there any basis in fact in how this all started?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's very sort of, there's a lot of subterfuge in it. I mean, the American CIA projects started in 1951 as Bluebird, and Office of Naval Intelligence actually started in 1947 with Chatter. But these were officially a response to the Korean War. Now, obviously, the Korean War is predated by these particular projects.
Okay, well, tell us about Chatter and Bluebird. What were they?
Well, Chatter was essentially an Office of Naval Intelligence operation to use things like mescaline, scopolamine, THC, which is an extract from marijuana, and various other drugs in interrogation scenarios to be used as truth serums. And I think it was Dr. Charles Savage, actually, of Bethesda Medical College, that actually was the chief officer in charge of that. Bluebird was the sort of, that was the CIA's first dalliance into it. And mysteriously, it started on April the 20th, which is Hitler's birthday, but I'm sure that's just a sad coincidence. And what they were interested in is controlling a man's will, subverting a man's will to make him do something that would normally go against his moral code, and so that they can control somebody covertly or control somebody in such a manner that they could split a personality, that they could have two very real personalities inside one man, and that could be flipped between one another for espionage purposes. Like,
yep.
For example, one could be very pro-communist and one could be an actual patriotic American.
Gosh, certainly that's the sort of thing the spy agencies would love if they could make that work. But you mentioned a truth serum. Surely that's just a myth, the idea that you can inject something into somebody and then they just tell you the truth, and all their defences, all their training to not tell you stuff would be broken down.
Well, a lot of it depends on the sort of how you treat the person. There's many ways. I mean, you can actually just sort of induce that sort of response by just isolating somebody for a very long period of time, or by forcibly socializing people, which is essentially what the sort of the Chinese methods were. They weren't anything new. They were just, wearying people and battering them psychologically. But then, so the Americans, particularly, were very interested in it, and they found that scopolamine was very, very useful. They found that in certain scenarios LSD was, but they also found that like certain types of hypnosis were actually very, very useful for renting information from people that weren't willing to give it. I mean, obviously, it's not as simple as you can't go up and just basically, right, you're under my control and tell them you have to work on this person psychologically and you have to either put them into a state whereby they depend on you or whereby they trust on you, trust you so much that they believe anything they reveal. You'd never put them in a scenario that would actually bring them to any sort of harm. So in order to do that in a hypnotic sense, you have to have incredibly, incredibly low sense of ethics and morals and just no scruples at all.
Now, is that what you found was happening? Because this is certainly one thing. I mean, if somebody is under the influence of psychotropic drugs,
yeah.
I mean, you'd need the whole thing would have to be very, very carefully looked at and supervised. Otherwise, I mean, you could possibly damage someone for life psychologically.
Well, absolutely. But, I mean, that's not a problem. I mean, there's dozens. I mean, Linda McDonald is one of the people that basically... She went. A lot of these experimentations, this is why they were so were able to get away with it, is because they were done by very, very prestigious medical doctors. I mean, Ewan Cameron and William Sargent, they were on the Nuremberg trials, you know, prosecuting Nazis, and they were basically in charge of entire departments. Ewan Cameron was the head of the World Psychiatric Association at the time that he was doing essentially LSD and electroshock experiments to wipe people's memories. But Linda McDonald, for example, she was about 21 when she went there for a sort of very mild case of depression. And when she left, she had no idea who she was. She couldn't remember her children. She couldn't remember her parents or her husband. She didn't even know what a husband was. She had to be taught to speak again. You know, they reduced it to an infinite, and these memories never returned.
Now, you're talking about the whole memory wipe thing there.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose that actually could be quite useful, couldn't it, in war as well, if someone's got a lot of secrets. What were the sort of applications of these things?
Well, I mean, essentially, the wiping of the memory is to prevent agents, when they're going into retirement, being taken by, that's probably a euphemism. It's basically to stop them telling everybody where the bodies are buried, really. You know, it's kind of like at the end of The Men in Black, where he comes up with that sort of device and just flashes it in front of people. But, I mean, that's why it was so cold and calculated, because a lot of these people were treating it as medical experiments. I mean, it can be very much likened to the experiments done by Joseph Mengele. In fact, a lot of the experimentation got its start from Joseph Mengele and various other doctors. They were doing experiments at Auschwitz, and they were doing experiments involving mescaline at Dachau and stuff like that. But, if you really want to go into it, this is kind of even older than that, because in sort of mystery religion-type texts and stuff like that, there are incantations and the use of certain potions and stuff like that. I mean, chanting, just the concept of chanting, that puts everybody in a sort of collective mind state. The idea of a mantra, that's a mind-control technique. You know, get everybody on their feet so they're tired, get their arms in the air so that they're weary, and get them to chant something mindless so that they dissociate or become bored.
Now, this whole idea of picking up where the Nazis left off, I wonder, do you think that explains some of the secrecy? Because, I mean, the Americans, the CIA, Naval Intelligence would say, well, we had to keep this secret because it's part of the military and we can't allow state secrets, a bit like they're saying about GCHQ and the NSA at the moment. So, I mean, was that used to cover up really totally unethical practices, or was there some justification for keeping it secret at the time?
Well, I mean, the official justification was we've got to, I think it was Alan Dulles that said, we have to keep these intellectual property away from the Russians. But, I mean, it's like your presentation itself. I watched your presentation very recently and then went and watched the World in Action program about Joseph Mengele living in South America. And, you know, he was not actively pursued until the late 50s, and he was captured about three times trying to escape from Germany by the Americans, by very various different squadrons or whatever, found out who he was and let go, just like various other ones. I mean, obviously we know about the Vatican Ratline, and we know about Operation Paperclip. Prouty, Fletcher Prouty, who's the guy that he was made immortalized by being played by Donald Sutherland in the JFK film, he started talking about Ewan Cameron, and Ewan Cameron's experiments were in, as I said, they were actually in Canada, but they were under the Subproject 68 of MK Ultra, which is the CIA's program. And Fletcher Prouty basically talks about this particular place, and he says a lot of doctors that were taken there were German, and a lot of them were actually paperclip doctors, because the official explanation is they all went to NASA, you know, Wernher von Braun and people like this, and they were there to expand the
They were
rocket.
Supposed to be rocket scientists, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, exactly. But obviously there was a lot of other... I mean, he's sort of washed over with sort of this concept of crazy genetic experiments and sewing heads together and trying to change the colour of eyes and stuff like that. I think a lot of that was mind control experiments. And one of the things that Mengele certainly did was called trauma bonding, which is essentially utilising trauma to... it kind of works like sorry to be glib, but it works in the same way that a pimp would control a prostitute through total fear. And essentially it breaks down your psychological process to the point where your ego is so small that any sort of... anything that goes wrong, you assume it must be your fault, and you assume that it's right and it's only correct that you should be punished for this. And it goes a step further, because basically when your abuser does punish you, you're aware that they are better than you, they're stronger than you, whatever. And they could, you know, given their want, they could kill you. And so when they don't kill you, you feel grateful for that, and you interpret that as love. And essentially that's kind of what is happening to society on a sort of grander scale. And it's no accident, you know, the constant traumatizing nature of increasing bills, constant terror on the streets, you know, terrorism, all this hyped up drama. And that goes back to an organization called the Tavistock Institute, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Their sort of concept was, it was called Future Shock. It was to basically traumatize the entire population to the point where they were in a constant state of fight or flight, reduced to a childlike state called fluidity, and then essentially authoritarians could come in with a sort of calm, sage-like expression and say, you know what would be the best option for all of you? This. And in that way you can control society.
Well, at least in theory. Naomi Klein has talked about this quite a bit as well.
Yeah.
But you mentioned there just briefly MKUltra. This is mm-hmm. something which is certainly wasn't designed at the time to be known about at the time and has only come out since in the US. Just tell us what MKUltra was.
Well, MKUltra is the umbrella term. It basically refers to... there was at least 149 sub-projects, so it's just an umbrella term. When people say MKUltra, what they mean is mind control projects by the CIA. There was MKDelta, MKQK Hilltop, MKChickwit, MKDelta, Derby Hat. There was many, many delineations, but they could all be broadly under the umbrella of mind control, either individual or social control, and basically... they run the whole gamut, and they run the whole gamut from sort of the use of drugs to the use of trauma to the use of coercion, the use of psychotronic machinery, implants, rays, electromagnetic waves, extremely low frequency waves, that sort of thing, right up to basically, you know, how it can control society through the use of the media, through the use of press releases, disguised advertising, disguised as a press release, you know, the amount of adverts that are disguised as news stories, that all they are is a fear-mongering exercise in selling a product.
Well, just give us an example.
Well, there's a new disease that's come out, blah-de-blah-de-blah, everybody's really, really up in arms about it. It's all right, though, because this company's got this new drug. That's an advertising. That, you know, you get these all the time. There's always some sort of... it's sold as a sort of... have you noticed this problem, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But the intertwining between advertising agencies and the news media, it goes to a shareholder level, it goes to a board level as well. So essentially, you know, you've got people that are on two different companies and want to do each other's favours. And aside from anything else, are bound by their loyalty and their legal requirement to their shareholders to do the best for them. And so, yeah, you often get this. You always get one when... when it's near an election, you'll get a politician doing something. Ah, crazy. There's always ones that are fake. Last time Obama got caught, he was apparently at a factory in Detroit, and it became very apparent that he was never there, and he was actually in front of a green screen, and the audience had been sort of superimposed afterwards and stuff like that. But it's to sell this product, the president, as a man of the people.
Now, one of the things that I find most fascinating about your research is looking at the way that some of these techniques were used maybe in the 50s and 60s on individuals, and then the way that those interpretations were then spread out to be used on the mass population. I mean, Naomi Klein, as I mentioned before, her film and book, The Shock Doctrine, I think it was her 2004, her third book, explores this, the idea that people are very easy to manipulate when they're being shocked. And also, going back to the 1970s, it almost looks as if these kinds of ideas were being used as a way of manipulating the population in Italy, which looked like it was going to vote for a communist government and bringing a communist government. Obviously, the Americans didn't want that. And so they instituted this thing called the strategy of tension. There were bomb attacks, which some of which were possibly by the Red Brigades and some of which were actually carried out by NATO. And the idea of a strategy of tension, that actually to have tension in the country is good for certain factions and certain politicians who are working for them, because it makes the population easy to manipulate. And I wonder, I mean, particularly with the tension to do with the you know, problems that people are having simply paying bills, staying in their own homes, you know, the threat of eviction, this kind of thing, that that technique might be being applied to Britain right now.
Yeah, absolutely it is, because there's no, particularly across the sort of fuel companies, because there's no justification or rationalisation for the increase in fuel prices. It's all based on speculation. And this is down to a government decision of privatisation. Yeah, they could step in, but no, it causes people to worry. And if people are worried, then people are looking out for one for themselves.
Okay,
which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, do you know what I mean? But again, excuse me, you're absolutely right. And it works in several levels. The sort of shocking things to distract you, because, you know, I can't be going down and marching against the war. I've got bills to pay. If I miss a day at work, you know, blah de blah de blah, I'm going to lose my house. So you've got all those sorts of levels of distraction.
Okay.
You've got the sort of terrorist aspect, and then you've got the entertainment industry in case you wanted something lighter.
Okay, to distract and dumb down. Anyway, The Manchurian Candidate.
Yeah.
Now, this is something which was, I think, probably one of the most famous films about this whole idea of mind control at a time when it was actually going on. It was quite controversial. Is there any truth to the idea of a Manchurian Candidate, someone who can be sent to do a task, do a job, and be virtually programmed like a computer to do it?
Yes, yes, there is. I mean, it sounds like science fiction. I think there has been a concerted effort to make people believe that it is science fiction. But yes, it certainly can be done, and it can be done in a number of ways. Say it can be done via a series of hypnotic controls. It can be done via hypnosis with the use of drugs. Scopolamine, for example. I mean, that's coming off in South America at the minute. I mean, people are basically just running up to people, blowing it in the face, and then getting them to empty their bank accounts. Like, if that's known by sort of hoodlums on the streets of Sao Paulo, you don't think he's going to be known by the CIA.
So this is a substance which, what it just sort of makes you compliant. This is rather frightening
stress.
Stuff, and I would have thought that any responsible government would want to make its population aware that this is going on, and also to control it somehow.
Well, very possibly. I mean, you know, this is the other thing, is there's a flip side, like we were just saying, when any of these stories come out. I mean, this is the sort of fine line that you walk. Talking about any of these topics is that they induce fear, and that is sort of their point, to induce fear, because basically, you know, you then freeze like a deer in the headlights. And Manchurian Candidates, they weren't full Manchurian Candidates, but they didn't actually do the shooting. But Mark Chapman and Sirhan Sirhan, the killers, or the supposed killers of John Lennon and Robert Kennedy, they were both under some sort of hypnotic control to perform an action of firing. But I believe that in both those cases, they actually fired blanks, and the actual killers were a bloke called Jose Podermo and Eugene Caesar, is my personal opinion, who both just so happened to work for the CIA. But yeah, there is, certainly you can do that. You can put voices in people's heads. I think it's called synthetic telepathy. There's also now very...
Hang on, just a second. You can put voices in people's heads. How?
Oh, yeah,
how?
Absolutely. You can carry it on... Well, there's several things that you can do, right? You can carry it on an electromagnetic wave pattern. You can essentially speak. There was several people it started with Alan Frey, I believe, the Frey auditory effect. He noticed that microwaves basically carry audible signals. From then on, they were able to sort of develop it. There's several people that can do it. Michael Persinger... Igor Smirnov was able to do it.
So what you're talking about, actually pointing a microwave beam at someone's head, yeah, and then them being able to actually hear, well, some voice in their ears. Is it? Well, I mean, are they talking? You're talking about it sort of agitating their eardrum or something? How does it work?
It basically forms a voice. It forms a voice that's like you're in a monologue, and this isn't even the most like scary stuff that they've got. I'll just give you a brief example. Igor Smirnov, who's a Russian, he actually has got a thing called the Smirnov pattern. It's now owned by SciTech, which is a CIA-run organization by John B. Alexander and Ingo Swann. They're into remote viewing and stuff like that. And Ed Dames, so I think he might be dead now. And basically, they bought the Smirnov pattern. It was going to be used during the Waco siege because essentially you can load a voice onto there and pump it directly into people's heads and they think that they're being spoken to, like from their own, inside their own head. And what they were going to do, they had Charlton Heston record a series of dialogue, and they were going to blast this at David Koresh, and he was going to pretend to be God, Charlton Heston, and tell him to peacefully end the siege. But they decided not to do that. But that's not the worst. Like the,
so they went in with tanks instead, didn't they, and burnt the place to the ground.
That it would be far more sporting to set fire to the front of the building and machine gun anybody that came out the back of the building. But, you know, I mean, the worst technology that I've sort of seen is, you know, basically every emotion release an EEG pattern. Your brain sort of releases electronic signals that can be determined as he is feeling this emotion or he is feeling that emotion. Well, you can use that because, say, when you feel hatred, like white hot anger, it pumps out a certain resonant spectrum. If you can get that, match that spectrum, put it onto a magnetic wave pattern and fire it at a brain, the brain doesn't know how to differentiate between an external source and an internal source. So it thinks it's making that emotion, so it makes that emotion, and you can't stop it. So it can reduce you to a blithering, blubbing mass or a white-hot psychopath within a second. And this, you know, silent sound technology, which was developed by Oliver Lowry and was actually used in the First Gulf War, admittedly, that does that. There's various other devices that basically do this. And again, it's very, very frightening because basically you would not know that these feelings are not organic. They are real feelings. It's just that essentially they've got in a step before the brain.
Amazing. Anyway, Neil, one of the most fascinating things you've been talking about, and I think actually really useful for us all, is to know about this drug, scopolamine?
Scopolamine, yeah.
Because that sounds to me like the sort of thing which there really should be a public awareness campaign about, if it is possible for unscrupulous people to use this to kind of persuade you that they're nice people and give away your credit card details, this kind of thing.
Scopolamine is not really a new drug. I mean, it was being used in the sort of early 50s by Harry Anslinger. Harry Anslinger was the very first drug czar of America and the person that basically made marijuana illegal because he was using marijuana, scopolamine and LSD, testing it illegally on unsuspecting patients of St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, which was a psychiatric hospital. But scopolamine is... There is a sort of awareness of it because basically it's been in the Daily Mail and stuff like that saying don't go to South America because you'll get sprayed with scopolamine. But it's one of these sort of cognitive dissonance things where people, oh, yeah, I know about scopolamine. Yeah, no, that's real. Mind control, no, that's impossible, that is. Because of the context in which it's been put.
I mean, it apparently induces confusion, agitation, rambling speech, hallucinations, paranoid behaviour and delusions. And, of course, when you're in that confused state, you're very, very open to suggestion by even some sort of passerby would seem like they're there to help you.
Absolutely. I mean, that's essentially how it works, is you can be coerced into anything. But this is, again, it's nothing new. Rohypnol, GHB, these are commonly known as date rape drugs. Even very strong MDMA, in America, it's called Molly, people have been known to drop it in people's drinks, and they become very, very excitable, shall we say, and then they can be easily coerced into sex.
Neil, before we leave you, it'd be nice to just have a few hints of a few websites and books, and then we'll finish with just talking about your own book.
Oh, well, yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, great books to find on the mind control subject. Anything by Jim Keith, Mass Control, World Control is fantastic. Jim Keith is unfortunately no longer with us. Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowers is superb. Anything by Dave McGowan, Program to Kill, The Politics of American Serial Killers, that's fantastic. That should be sort of standard reading for anybody, really.
And where can we find you online?
On me? Well, I have my own website, which is neilsandersmindcontrol.com, and on there there's a series of videos of past presentations, radio appearances, and, you know, bits and bobs, a few YouTube videos that I've done. I'm also on Facebook. If anybody would like to, you know, like my page, you can ask me questions, you know, get in touch with me. I'm usually posting stuff on there. And you can buy my book. Well, it's actually split into two volumes, actually. I didn't explain. The first one's called Mind Control, Mass Manipulation and Perception Management. And the second one, volume two, is called Marketing, Movies and Music. And obviously it discusses marketing, movies and music and social control and the LSD experiments that sort of coincided with the you know, the hippie movement. Oh, by the way, if you want to know about LSD as well, Acid Dreams by Bruce Schlein and Martin A. Lee is very, very good for that sort of thing, and Inside the LC by Dave McGowan. But my books are available at neilsandersmindcontrol.com, and they're available at richplanet.net.
Okay, well, Neil Saunders, author of Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, published in December 2012. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect. Chrissy Hynde and Mood Swings, and a song called Spiritual High, and it's a super extended Tony Gosling version, just because I couldn't find a version that I absolutely wanted. And I actually, what I did is I got a couple of different versions of that song and mixed them together, so I hope they don't mind. And quite appropriate, I think, a bit of a spiritual high after hearing about some of the nasty mind control stuff. Anyway, I'm joined in the studio now by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason, again, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
What you got for us this week in the news?
Well, first of all, we've got a little bit on fracking. We've got the all-party group on unconventional oil and gas, which, as it turns out, is quite a lot of it sponsored by fracking lobbyists.
Well, that's amazing. Let's hear from you in a minute about the specific individuals who are doing that and companies. One of the things I found out about fracking this week, reading through some wartime history, this is one of the, I think it's a book called The Most Secret War, which was written about the scientific intelligence sections of the British Army during World War II, was that right towards the end of the war, when the Nazis were absolutely desperate for oil and petrochemicals, that they started doing, guess what? Fracking. Using shale gas and shale oils as an absolute last-ditch method to try and get fuel, when most of the rest of the fuel from other parts of the world had been cut off and their tanks were starting to slow down and stop. So it was even back by the Nazis, it was seen as an absolute desperate measure to try and get hold of fossil fuels.
It is shocking. And actually, here what we've got now, we've got the all-party group on unconventional oil and gas, which in February received £25,000 from a bunch of firms, including Cadrilla, the petrochemical giant INEOS, which lobbies for fracking and is reportedly negotiating to invest in Cadrilla, the UK Onshore Operators Group, which is a fracker's trade body, and Ovi Arup, an engineering firm which did environmental impact assessment in Blackpool for fracking, and also, coincidentally, in Sattertil in Norway. So, among the 20 MPs on this all-party group, which is being sponsored by fracking specialists, is a former energy minister, Charles Henry.
Now, we've also had, haven't we? I seem to remember at the weekend we had earthquakes in Blackpool. We were told and assured that this had nothing to do with the fact that Blackpool was the area which had been used the year before last, or 2011 and 12, by Cadrilla for testing fracking. And that this had absolutely nothing to do with frackers whatsoever. So,
well, if you ask me, Tony, I think that's a fracking load of nonsense.
Okay, well, I mean, it surprises me that they can instantly come out with a denial that it's anything to do with it, because one of the, well, it's well known actually, it's a very good Telegraph article which explains that effect is that it does actually cause minor earthquakes. And what happens is that because of the changes, particularly through the injection of water into areas below the normal water table where normal water wouldn't normally be, what happens is that the Earth's plates then actually start to move. It acts as a sort of lubricant and friction in a way that they would never normally do. And so one does wonder if there is any real justification that this is safe, if it's now again causing two, we think, it looks like anyway, causing two earthquakes in just off the shore in Blackpool.
Yes, I mean, it's absolutely shocking. I mean, I mentioned last week about the fact that this could poison the water table. Knowing that, by the way, coming back to the all-party group on unconventional oil and gas, they've been provided a secretariat, and guess who's provided it?
Don't tell me the oil industry.
It is Edelman, the lobbying firm which represents Cadrilla.
So these people seem to have almost fantastic amount. I mean, we have got disabled people who don't have enough money to pay their bills, we have Cadrilla and these fracking companies who are destroying the planet. We seem to have almost infinite supplies of money. Also, going back to the earthquake story, These earthquakes were just as close to Sellafield, which is the British nuclear fuels reprocessing plant, as they were to Blackpool. So roughly halfway between the two.
Oh, wow.
Now, they've
one place
said...
you don't want an environmental disaster, Sellafield.
Isn't it interesting that we've been told that, oh, we could never get a tsunami in this part of the world, which like happened to Fukushima. And in Fukushima, by the way, over the last week or so...
The radioactive water
has been pouring out of the protective barrier and over the top. I don't know if you heard, but the Japanese are absolutely desperate for foreign help with it, because they're saying the only thing we can think of doing is trying to cryogenically freeze the water so that it doesn't leak out. Sounds like it's an absolute disaster there. If these earthquakes go any closer to Sellafield, we could have the same kind of thing here.
God, yeah, I mean, just imagine that, if you will, Tony, if this radioactive material gets into a river, maybe a major river, if it gets into the nearest major river to Sellafield. I don't actually know where Sellafield is, admittedly, but it must be somewhere near there.
Cumbria. One of the biggest dangers, of course, with Fukushima is that we're going to start to get poisoning of fish products of fish.
We might get radioactive sushi, which I'm sure would please the Russians.
Well, radioactive. I mean, do you have to switch the lights off before you put it in your fridge just to test to see if this stuff glows in the dark? I mean, we can flippantly joke about it, but the trouble is, of course, how many households have got radiation detectors, and how safe is our food? We know, for example, that we've been being supplied horse meat for many, many months, probably years, being told it was beef. Now, are we going to get told if there's radiation in our fish?
It's like fluoride and toothpaste, isn't it, really?
But we're not going to get told if there's radiation in our fish. I mean, this is the trouble.
I'd move on to the next story. Here is this one will make you laugh. The US National Security Agency is trying to reassure the world that it's only snooping on us a little bit.
Is that a quote from the National Security Agency?
Not quite. They say they said the only bit we've only read 1.6% of the 1,826 petabytes of information carried by the internet each day.
They're being sneaky, aren't they? Because they have only read that. But what about their computers? What have they read?
It's not just that. It's worth bearing in mind that most of the internet is awful. There's a lot of things like cat pictures and pirated movies and slightly more illicit stuff that probably isn't fit for radio to discuss. And according to Sandvine, according to the company, networking company Sandvine, communications such as email account for just 2.9% of the total. Now, the fact is that most email is spam, up to 70%, according to Kaspersky. You've got to wonder exactly which bits of the internet data is actually being monitored by the NSA. And it says in the private eye they doubt that it's Viagra or lottery wins.
Well, listen, we've only got about a minute left, so you better do your ATOS stories. I know you love them, but we mustn't miss them out.
Here we are, yes. So where do we start with this? I mean, millions of pounds for UK's taxpayers assessing whether or not they're fit to work. We've got an interesting story. We've got a couple of interesting stories here. The first of which is that a graduate called Jamie Shield, who was told he was fit to work and as a wheelchair user, actually applied for a job with Atos, and it withdrew his invitation for an interview on the grounds that the office he'd be made to work with is on the 6th floor, and their lift only went up to the 5th floor.
Okay, so that's Atos themselves he wanted to work for. I suppose that's one way of disabled people finding out what Atos are up to. What about your other story?
My other story is even worse. GPs are charging up to £130 to help people with Atos disability appeals. This is family doctors are charging sick and disabled people up to £130 medical evidence to appeal their decisions. NHS GPs are telling patients they will only provide the necessary details to challenge controversial work capability assessments if they pay, and some are refusing to help at all. Now, Citizens Advice Bureaus in 11 different parts of Britain say that GP in the area is only helping with the appeal if patients pay a fee of anywhere between £25 and £130. There was a report that from 15 of the charity's advice centres that family surgeries are refusing to provide any evidence. In some cases, this means unwell people who have already had their benefits stopped are left with no recourse to justice because their GPs refuse to help or are charging high fees.
Now, I noticed also, Jason, another doctor, there's been one in The Guardian, but another one has come into the British Medical Journal also criticising ATOS, saying that he couldn't actually, in all conscience as a doctor, sign things he was being persuaded to by them. But anyway, thanks very much for your news review. And that's it for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. That's our new time after the new schedule. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Sorry we didn't have time for the Eco Village this week. We'll do that next week. Thanks to our studio guest, Neil Saunders. Your thoughts are not your own, the author of that, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadback co-op production. Anyone can contribute if you'd like to. Do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733, and you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Ciepłe lato, choć czasem padało, dużo wina się piło i mało się spało. Tak zaczęła się wakacyjna przygoda. On był jeszcze młody i ona była młoda. Zakochani przy świetle księżyca nocami chodzili długimi leśnymi ścieżkami. Tak mijały tygodnie, lecz rozstanie nadszedł czas. Zawsze mówił jedno zdanie, moje śliczne ty kochanie. Ostatniego dnia tych pamiętnych wakacji kochali się namiętnie w męskiej ubikacji. Przysięgli przed Bogiem miłość wzajemną, że za rok się spotkają i na zawsze ze sobą już będą. W samotności przeżył jesień, zimę, wiosnę. Nie wytrzymał do wakacji, postanowił ją odwiedzić, bo nie dostał już dawno od niej żadnej odpowiedzi. Gdy przyjechał do jej domu po dość długiej podróży, cieszył się, że ją zobaczy. W końcu tyle dla niej znaczył, lecz gdy ona go ujrzała, szybko się schowała. Drzwi mu matka otworzyła, no i tak mu powiedziała: Agnieszka, już dawno tutaj nie mieszka. O nie, nie, nie. Agnieszka, już dawno tutaj nie mieszka. Agnieszka, już dawno tutaj nie mieszka. O nie, nie. Agnieszka, już dawno tutaj nie mieszka. Cierpiał całą jesień, trochę zimy, no i wiosnę. A gdy przeszło mu zupełnie, pojechał na wakacje w tamto miejsce, by zobaczyć tę pamiętną ubikację. Tak się stało, że przypadkiem ona też tam była. Ucieszyła się ogromnie, gdy go tylko zobaczyła. Zapytała się, czy w sercu jego jest jeszcze Agnieszka. Odpowiedział: